Hey, everyone. It's Here and Now producer Chris Bentley.
And Here and Now co-host Scott Tong. Hey, Chris, what have you been up to?
Well, Scott, I've been working on something that I'm excited to tell you and our listeners about. It's a new version of our podcast.
Ooh.
Dropping into the Here and Now feed this month. And I'll be hosting it for the time being.
Oh, I love it. Now, just so you know, everyone, our reporters and co-hosts you know and you love, we'll still bring you the news, analysis, arts, culture, everything the light touches. But our podcast is going to be curated by Chris and his team, and it will deliver our best stories, right?
Yeah, that's right. We're going to rely on the same great journalism and storytelling that our producers and hosts and editors produce every day.
Mm-hmm.
Deep stories that you can't hear anywhere else, as well as some exclusive things that you won't hear on our radio show.
Okay, so if you want to hear everything from our show, go to hereandnow.org.
And for the new podcast, all you have to do is download it from the regular Here and Now feed starting this month.
I'll be there. Chris, thank you.
Thanks, Scott. And thanks, everyone, for listening.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Celeste Headlee in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Jane Clayson in Boston. This is Here and Now. The 50 migrants flown to Martha's Vineyard this week will now be staying at a military base off the island on nearby Cape Cod, Massachusetts. The migrants were in Texas, many seeking asylum, when Florida Governor Ron DeSantis orchestrated a political stunt, flying them to Massachusetts earlier this week. WBUR's Simone Rios spoke with a migrant about why he left his home for the U.S. He did not give his name for fear of deportation.
We left Venezuela because we felt threatened. We were threatened by criminals, but also by the government.
Meanwhile, a lawyer for the migrants, Rachel Self, said migrants were lied to before boarding the planes.
They were told there was a surprise present for them, and that there would be jobs and housing awaiting for them when they arrived. This was obviously a sadistic lie.
Bianca Padro Ocasio is political writer for the Miami Herald, and she's on Martha's Vineyard. Bianca, how many of these migrants are from Venezuela, and what are they saying about their arrival at Martha's Vineyard?
A lot of the migrants that I've been speaking to, basically, they have been through really harrowing journeys in the past several weeks. Ended up in San Antonio, Texas, in a shelter where they were essentially told by an unidentified woman, is what we've gathered from all of their accounts, who told them that if they boarded a plane, they could be guaranteed 3 months of work, they could get housing, and they were given color-coded maps of the United States with a line drawn from Texas to Massachusetts so they could locate themselves. And that is all they knew before they landed in Martha's Vineyard. There was no one to receive them. And of course, what we're hearing from attorneys is that they believe this was intentional to create a sort of crisis situation of migrants landing in a wealthy enclave of Massachusetts.
There's something else that the attorney Rachel Self said. She said the Department of Homeland Security falsified addresses for the migrants. And she says this could end up causing big problems as their legal cases proceed. Can you explain what this is about?
Sure. So essentially what the lawyers told us was the migrants had all this paperwork with them when they left Texas, and they all had different addresses in different parts of the country. And essentially what that does is they have to show up to immigration court in the jurisdiction near the address that they listed. So some of them had hearings that were scheduled as early as Monday morning in places like Tacoma, Washington, Washington, D.C. So essentially, it's creating this vacuum where a lot of the migrants are now having to scramble to figure out if they're able to attend their hearings. And most of them are just worried, according to the lawyers, about compliance and just being able to make sure that they can have a legal process, that, you know, some of them want to apply for political asylum, but others may seek other legal avenues, like applying for other types of visas. One thing that Rachel Self told us was she does believe that there's a case to be made that the migrants were victims of a crime, and this obviously makes them eligible for other types of visas to stay in the country. So essentially what we know right now is that it's unclear exactly who orchestrated this. I mean, obviously, we know that Governor Ron DeSantis has taken credit for this, But we're still figuring out exactly, you know, how this was orchestrated, exactly, you know, who falsified these addresses, as the lawyers are claiming. There's just so many questions. And we're really, I'm telling you this as somebody who reports from Miami, we're getting very few answers from the governor's office in Florida about why this happened this way and how it was orchestrated.
And also, California Governor Gavin Newsom is calling for an investigation into whether this action broke federal law. This flight originated in Texas, in San Antonio. It was paid for with taxpayer money. As you mentioned, you're based in Miami. What's the reaction from Florida taxpayers?
So I think this is something that has been no secret to people in Florida, that the state legislature appropriated $12 million for the governor's busing program for migrants in the state illegally. Obviously, there's a lot of questions about whether any of these migrants were ever in Florida. But I think that there's a lot of people who obviously are supporters of the governor and believe that this is just him doing the thing that he said he would do. But obviously a lot of outrage from a lot of Venezuelans that feel very close to the situation, who see their own family members in the faces of the people who were brought here. And like, you know, the lawyer Rachel Self said, there's several layers of deception here, from being told that they were going to find something that they didn't, to, you know, now having to figure out a way to go to another state and figure out job opportunities and a legal journey for them. And we did hear from some of them today that they are planning to go to Miami, Florida, because of family members and friends and a large Venezuelan community that exists there already.
Bianca Padro Ocasio is political writer for the Miami Herald. Bianca, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Former federal judge Raymond Deary will soon be sorting through the more than 11,000 documents the FBI seized from former President Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago home. A federal judge appointed Deary as special master to conduct the review. The judge also rejected a Justice Department request to allow investigators to use classified materials seized from Mar-a-Lago in the FBI's ongoing criminal probe. Let's find out more about Raymond Deary and the impact this will have with NPR Justice correspondent Ryan Lucas. Hi, Ryan.
Hi there.
So Deary was appointed by Ronald Reagan. He's had a long career. He also served on the government's intelligence surveillance court. Can you fill in his resume for us?
Well, as you said, he was nominated by President Reagan to serve as a district court judge in the Eastern District of New York. That was back in 1986. So he's been on the federal bench for more than three decades. He's very well respected. He has obviously years and years of experience. That includes a term on the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which is the court that oversees sensitive national security cases involving things like terrorism or espionage. Over the course of his career, he's handled high-profile cases, including terrorism and organized crime cases in New York. People who know him have said that, you know, he's a very sound, very fair, very smart, a very thoughtful judge, and they have described him as essentially a good pick for the job at hand here.
So Deary was suggested for the role of special master by the Trump legal team, and the DOJ was open to his appointment. Are there any clues as to why Trump would approve him reviewing these documents?
Well, that's a good question. The Justice Department rejected other names that Trump's team put forward. As for why Deary, it's really not clear why Trump thought that Deary would be the man for the job. But in many ways, you know, the person who serves as special master may not matter as much for Trump as merely getting a special master appointed. And that's because having a special master review all of these documents that were seized from Mar-a-Lago, some 11,000 in all, it slows down this whole thing, this federal criminal investigation. In essence, it just kind of gums up the works here. So that may be the bigger issue here for Trump rather than who the individual is, him or herself.
I see. So what is Deary going to be looking for then as he sifts through all these documents?
Well, according to the order that was issued last night by Judge Eileen Cannon in Florida, she's tasked Deary with reviewing, as I said, the 11,000 or so documents that the FBI took from Mar-a-Lago in its court-authorized search. And Deary is supposed to go through them, identify any that could potentially be covered by attorney-client privilege or executive privilege or documents that are, say, personal items. Cannon has instructed Deary to prioritize the roughly 100 classified documents that the FBI took from Mar-a-Lago. Those are the documents that are really at issue here. And remember, Cannon has barred the FBI from using those documents in its ongoing criminal investigation. The Justice Department had asked the judge for a stay on that, in essence, requesting that investigators be able to use those documents in the investigation and asking that they not be turned over to whoever was appointed special master. Last night, Judge Cannon denied that request. She said, in essence, that she didn't buy the argument that the criminal investigation is inextricably intertwined with an ongoing intelligence community review of them. The Justice Department is expected to appeal that to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals.
So the judge is giving the special master until November 30th to finish his work, which is mm-hmm. after the midterm election. What are the political and legal implications for delaying the Justice Department's own review of these documents?
Well, I think the most important implications here really are the national security implications. All of this, as I said, is slowing down the criminal investigation into obstruction and willful retention of national defense information. And the Justice Department has said repeatedly in its court filings that there is a major national security risk here to slowing all of this down. It says it's imperative to conduct its classification review that the intelligence community is doing, as well as a risk assessment to see the possible damage for the potential disclosure of these materials. So while this does kind of kick this beyond the midterms in early November, certainly for the Justice Department and for U.S. national security agencies, the big question here really is the impact that this could have on U.S. national security.
NPR Justice Correspondent Ryan Lucas. Ryan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
In London, the line to see the Queen's casket now stretches 5 miles down the River Thames. Meanwhile, King Charles III is in Wales as part of his tour of the country, where he faces silent protests. For more on the upcoming funeral of Queen Elizabeth, we turn to NPR's London correspondent, Frank Langfitt. Hi, Frank.
Hi, Jane.
So there's been quite a turnout, a huge turnout, to see the Queen's casket. You were down along the lines yesterday. What was it like?
Well, it's really interesting. Yesterday, it wasn't that bad. I mean, maybe it was 3 miles and the lines were moving very quickly. But today, I think people have seen what's happening and people are pouring in, not just from outside of London, but from coming in from great distances from the north of England. It's now, as you were saying, it's 5 miles down the Thames. And they're now saying that it could take up to 24 hours for people at the end of the line to make it up to Parliament, which is where the Queen is lying in state. And I've covered a lot of events here, Jane, Brexit, the wedding of Prince Harry and Meghan, the Duchess of Sussex, but I've never seen anything quite like this. Now, when I was down there yesterday, we were talking to a guy named Steve Cass. He'd been waiting for maybe an hour and a half. He'd come in from Portsmouth, which is about 75 miles away, and this is what he had to say.
I was debating whether to come or not, and then had a word with myself last night and didn't want to be kicking myself if I hadn't. So whatever length of the queue is, I think it'll be worth it today to pay respects.
And Jane, what was really interesting today is most of the people there were just, you know, regular, ordinary Britons, but there were even some famous people in the crowd. David Beckham, of course, a global retired former soccer star. He started at 2 a.m. in the morning in the line, and he walked for 12 hours. He said he was eating Pringles, drinking coffee, eating sandwiches.
Wow.
And he is a very, very strong royalist. And I think it was an emotional moment for a lot of people to see him willing to walk with everybody else, you know, upstream the Thames and over the bridge and into the building.
That's incredible. Well, it's been 25 years since Princess Diana's funeral in 1997. Does the atmosphere today feel similar as crowds line up to pay their respects?
I think different. I wasn't here then. Of course, I watched on television as everybody did when it happened as well. I think what's different here is, you know, when Diana died, she was in her 30s. She was a mother. It was a tragic, violent death, a car crash at night in Paris. And I think, as we remember, even the British people were shocked at how emotional they were. It's a cliche to say that they're reserved, but that is true in many ways. This is very different. This is the monarch who died at 96, so it was not a surprise. That said, she has been such a fixture in this country. I mean, if I open my wallet right now, her face is on the pound coin. It's on some of the bills, you know. And so she's just been there for most people the entire time. And as she grew older over the years, she sort of became, you know, the nation's grandmother. Hmm.
What's your sense, Frank? Is everyone there caught up in the lead up to the Queen's funeral?
No, I don't think they are. And I think it's important to remember that while the crowds are extraordinary, this is a big city of many million people. And yesterday when I was down along the South Bank of the Thames, I met a woman named Ellis May. She's an art student who studies in East London. And she was sitting next to the line as it was kind of like snaking around her. And I said, "Are you interested?" She said, "No." She said she respected the Queen. But when I asked her about the new king, King Charles III, her son, you know, May was not impressed and sort of felt that the royal family did have, some members had a sense of entitlement. And she cited this video that's gotten quite a bit of play here in the UK, in which King Charles is signing an oath and he runs out of room on his desk and he seems irritated. He grimaces and gestures for one of his aides to remove it. And here was May's take.
"It's a bit rude because, in my opinion, I would have just moved it. It's not in the way, but it's like, you didn't even say, 'Can you move this, please?' Like, just general manners. I thought it was really rude when I saw that. I couldn't believe it. Because it's just like treating people like they're lower than you."
Yeah, a lot of people saw that one. King Charles has been traveling the country, Frank, since his mother died. Today he's in Wales. Tell us how that went.
Yeah, well, he used to be the Prince of Wales, and his son William is now heir to the throne. He took over that title. And the royal tour, Jane, is kind of a way of shoring up support for the monarchy at this time of transition. And King Charles, he addressed the Welsh Parliament, which is called the Senate. He addressed them in Welsh. There were small protests as he drove into Cardiff Castle. There were more than 100 people who were waving signs saying, "Not my king, no to the monarchy, no to Charles," things along those lines. Of course, nothing compared to the kind of crowds that we've seen in London over the last couple of days.
Well, the funeral is Monday, and people around the world will be watching. That's NPR's London correspondent, Frank Langfitt. Frank, thanks as always.
Great to talk, Jane.
The Handmaid's Tale is back for its fifth season, and it has come a long way from the book on which it's based. So let's talk about what's happening on Handmaid's Tale and get a look at the final season of FX's Atlanta, which launched today. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans joins us. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
Okay, so for those who've never read the original book by Margaret Atwood or seen the show, The Handmaid's Tale is about this fictional future in which a theocratic government overthrows the U.S. The government is very brutal towards women. The main character is kept in sexual slavery for years before escaping. How far has this story on TV evolved from when it first aired in 2017?
Well, they've really sort of built out the world. In the book, you get a hint of this. You know, you're told that America is sort of split in two. Gilead is the theocratic part, and then the Americans are fighting them. In the TV show, Canada is on the side of the Americans, and indeed, several of the characters that we meet that are abused by the government in Gilead, including the lead character played by Elizabeth Moss, they escape to Canada. Now, the last season ended with a really shocking death. Spoiler alert, you know, if you haven't watched it, I'm just letting you know I'm going to drop something big here. But at the end of the last season, we saw Fred, the commander who had abused Elizabeth Moss's character. She wound up killing him. She figured out a way to get him isolated. And she and a bunch of other women who were refugees from Gilead killed him. So there's a scene that happens where Elizabeth Moss's character, June, has come back just after she's killed Fred, and she talks to her husband and a friend who's living with them to tell them what she's done. Let's check it out.
"Hey, where are you going? June, whose blood is that? Hey, whose blood is that?
Hey, what's going on?
What happened?
I did it.
You did what?
I killed him.
What?
I killed Fred."
Yeah, and that's pretty powerful. And then as we get into the new season, we see the impact that vengeance has. And we also see the wife of the commander, Serena Waterford, who's played by Yvonne Strahovski. She's elevated by this sort of QAnon, Trumpian kind of movement that has people in Canada who worship her. And so so much of this feels like, of course, what we're going through today, but sort of rendered through this horrific dystopian lens.
Even more relevant in the headlines recently was a 15-year-old girl who was raped and ended up killing her rapist, the man who sex trafficked her. So even that has connections to this show. Do you feel The Handmaid's Tale, in some ways, is kind of prophetic of where we now are?
Yeah, most definitely. And, you know, it may be difficult for some people to watch for that reason. When you see something happen like the Supreme Court's dissolution of Roe v. Wade, you hear people talking about the possibility of civil war when people react badly to Donald Trump being investigated. You know, watching this stuff on The Handmaid's Tale is going to feel very relevant. And it's constantly asking, you know, these really urgent and disquieting questions about, you know, where will our society be if we don't figure out a way to come to a more harmonious answer on some of these questions?
It seems like an odd turn to now talk about a comedy like FX's Atlanta. But at the same time, Atlanta also is talking about current headlines, right? I mean, it's tying in through satire to the state of race and racism in America. It has been a cult favorite for quite some time. How is the new season?
Well, it's really interesting. So the fourth season is the show's last season. And as always, you know, they have these absurdist episodes, but eventually they come together to tell you something that you don't expect. So one episode, Donald Glover's character, Earn, starts to see a therapist to unpack why he's feeling so tense.
I have a tightness in my chest and a pain numbness going down my left arm.
But the episode story is also focused on this white woman who wants to be a children's author.
You think that I could get signed?
Signed? Kid, the story of yours could be the biggest payday since the Bernstein Bears, or Berenstain, you get it.
No, I get it.
And it's hard to tell why are we going back and forth between these two stories, but there's a moment at the end of the episode where the two stories come together, and all of a sudden you understand why they did it. And the show does things like this all the time, and sometimes things are explained, sometimes they're not. That's part of the charm of the show, but as a viewer, it can leave you constantly trying to decode small little things, and sometimes that's rewarded and sometimes it's not.
Right. It's like, what does this mean? And they're saying, what do you think it means?
Exactly.
Right. It can be part of the charm. NPR TV critic Eric Diggins. Eric, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Three years ago, the Florida grasshopper sparrow was on the verge of extinction. Now the bird's population is rebounding thanks to an emergency effort to breed them in captivity and then release them. WMFE's Amy Green reports from the Central Florida Prairie, the only place on Earth where these birds are found in the wild.
The Florida grasshopper sparrow is a drab, brown-colored bird no larger than the palm of your hand. That captive race sparrow was 45 days old when he was released last year among the saw, palmetto, and wiregrass of the Central Florida Prairie, not far from Walt Disney World. After surviving the winter, he established a breeding territory and paired with a wild mate. He was recorded this spring by a conservation group documenting the releases.
They sound a bit of like an insect. They go like...
Juan Oteza of the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission has spent hours on the prairie observing the sparrows. Wildlife agencies began releasing the sparrows on the prairie in 2019 after agonizing debate. No one knew whether the effort would be successful. The sparrow was North America's most endangered bird, with only about 80 left in the wild. Some feared the releases would condemn the sparrows to extinction, for example, if a disease spread from captive birds to wild ones. Since then, the sparrows have wowed researchers with their resilience. The captive race sparrows have paired and bred with their wild colleagues, producing offspring that also are breeding. Oteza says the number of birds at the initial release site has doubled, and the wild population has jumped to more than 120.
We often just see them and don't really think of them as release birds. And that's a great thing, right? They just incorporated into the wild population really well.
Some of the captive race sparrows began their lives far from the prairie, at the Brevard Zoo. The zoo's Kelly Courier keeps her voice low to avoid spooking the skittish sparrows as her colleague steps inside a wooden and wire mesh enclosure with a morning meal of crickets and worms.
It is how you act when you're in here. If you are calm, they can feel it, and if you are slow, it affects how they are gonna act as well.
It's just like a baby.
Exactly, yeah.
The Brevard Zoo is one of four locations where the sparrows are being raised. Here, each enclosure is like a little patch of the prairie with tall wild grasses and branches where the sparrows can perch and look out. The staff spends hours preparing their meals and observing them. Courier has a favorite sparrow she nicknamed Wild One for the bird's fierce devotion to her hatchlings. Still, Courier says she is never sad to see them go to the prairie.
I want for every one of these birds to be out there living their life that they want to live. So I'm so happy when they go. It's like, bye, good luck.
The Florida grasshopper sparrow still faces many threats. The population remains so small that one thing could wipe it out, like a disease or weather event. And Oteza says the sparrow's plight is a sign of other problems.
This problem may be associated with climate change. It may be associated with habitat degradation or habitat loss.
Perhaps the biggest threat here in fast-growing Central Florida is the prairie itself is vanishing as it is overtaken with development. For NPR News, I'm Amy Green in Melbourne, Florida.
Acclaimed Nigerian author Wole Soyinka has written everything from plays to poetry, essays, and novels. He was the first Black African person to win the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1986, and he has taught and lectured all over the world. At the age of 88, you could say this writer has gained some perspective on politics and society. And that's what we wanted to speak with him about when we caught up with him on a recent visit to the United States. His homeland of Nigeria is a former British colony. It gained independence in 1960 when Soyinka was in his 20s. So I asked him his reaction to the death of Queen Elizabeth II.
Well, Queen Elizabeth has been more or less a symbolic head of the Commonwealth. So there's no sense of, governance contact between the royal family and Nigeria and presumably all other nations. But of course, she represents a certain era, a certain relationship, and one feels saddened for the family and for the people of England as well. But basically, I don't think her death is going to affect anything going on in Nigeria. I think Nigeria would be more concerned with who's the new Prime Minister of England. I think that is where all the sights are beamed in Nigeria.
You know, you have written a lot about corruption and misbehavior in government. And I wonder if you feel that part of the at least administrative, legislative, governmental struggles that not just Nigeria but other African nations have had can be traced back to the youth of some of these nations, that they gained their independence so very recently. Do you think that matters?
No, I don't like to make excuses. Definitely, the immediate trajectory of former colonies is already handicapped by the colonial experience, from taking orders from across the ocean to being in charge of your own affairs. One shouldn't expect it to be a smooth process. Unfortunately, you see, the British and all other colonial powers, they did a rather messy job in getting out. So I admit, I absolutely insist on our memories not being cauterized in that respect. However, I believe that leadership since then ought to have overcome a number of these problems. I don't think that right now we should be having such a stream of refugees across the Sahara, across the Atlantic, desperate, just for sheer basic economic survival. But the reason is that our productive processes were completely bastardized by the actions of the British when they were leaving. And that indentureship, we still feel it. But again, I keep saying, our leaders by now should really have overcome all those handicaps.
I was reading an interview with someone from East Africa who was saying that, if nothing else, the death of Elizabeth II, while sad, represents closure, the end of an era. I wonder if, I wonder if you think that's true, that it brings some measure of relief, but also, is there some other way that Britain could have brought about closure? You've talked about the mistakes that the nation made, but what could Britain have done to make this easier? Could they have apologized? What could they have done?
We're getting into the realms, shall we say, of reparations now, if you like, or I prefer the word restitution. First of all, I don't accept the fact that the death of Queen Elizabeth is the end of an era. It is, from the historic point of view of Europe, and for the United Kingdom, of course. But, I mean, the Queen is dead, long live the King. Isn't that the expression? And it's more than just a mere slogan. I doubt very much if the relationship is going to change. And to look at the death of a symbolic head of an organization as an opportunity for other things, better or worse, it's a very strange way of looking at it. I don't feel it that way. I don't believe that there's a sharp cleavage now between the past and the future simply because of this death. I don't think so. Our problems are far too intense and far too, you know, almost intractable than that. Nigeria, the situation in Nigeria, West Africa, the level, for instance, of insecurity, of poverty, for instance, the division between the classes, the haves and have-nots, and so on, which really have widened in a really disastrous way. It'd be very naive to expect that all this will change simply because the titular head of an organization to which we belong is dead.
So you have also, I mean, you are a global celebrity, a literary celebrity. You're a Nobel Prize winner. You have been visiting and lecturing in the United States for one, but other nations as well. You were educated in the UK, at least for part of it. And that gives you a unique perspective, especially on not just other governments, but the way democracy is doing globally.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder, when you look at the state of democracy now, especially in some place like the United States, which has long called itself the bastion of democracy, where democracy is in trouble, what goes through your mind?
What is on my mind is that I wish the United States would avoid setting a bad example. Because what happened in the States over the past few years, the emergence of Trump in particular and his persistence in subverting civil society, it gives joy to the dictators, to the corrupt, to the unconscionable all over the continent. And so when it's bad news in the United States, I'm afraid it's worse news for third world countries. Look at the deterioration of situation in countries like Russia, for instance. Their liberal democracy was supposed to have taken hold. And now you have this feudalist thug called Putin, who's now flexing his muscle all over the place, also giving encouragement to those violent, petty dictators that we have on the continent. I don't consider it a coincidence, for instance, that there's a rash of reversals with the military coming back in some of the countries on the African continent. So the combination of all these, both the, shall we say, the expected exemplars, deterioration, and those reversals in places like the Soviet Union, which was supposed to be a progressive nation and been transforming itself, it doesn't spell much optimism for many people in the third world. It's a great pity.
So I also wanted to touch on another issue that the U.S. is grappling with, other nations as well, but here in the United States, we're seeing a rise in censorship. We are seeing librarians under attack, organized groups trying to pull books off of shelves. You are no stranger to repression and censorship. You were thrown into jail because of things you'd written. You continued to write. I wonder if you have any advice for American authors and librarians based on your experience with fighting censorship for so long.
This is not the first time it's been tried. I remember some years, especially after the 9/11 catastrophe. You see, the fascist opportunists are always lurking in the wings. And that is something which the United States need to be aware of. I mean, it's like even going all the way back to the Makatide on American activities, period. This is the meaning of this kind of censorship.
Are you referring to the McCarthy era?
Yeah, I'm referring to that. And Liberians must find a way of resisting it. And elections are coming. And where the danger is that when America is close to elections, candidates, whether Republican and the Democratic Party, both Senate and House of Representatives, begin to hedge their bets. They don't want to offend a section of the electorate, and so they water down even their Democratic pronouncements on their Democratic credentials and program just to get over the hump of elections. And that is when you get one Trump, then you get two Trumps, and then three Trumps, and you have an entire community of Trumps. And so Mr. Donald Trump won't have to do anything anymore. He'll just let his lieutenants do the dirty work for him. So the Trumpian danger is not over in the United States.
Wole Soyinka, Nigerian playwright, poet, teacher, Nobel laureate, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Some of the biggest names in the NBA say the league's investigation into the owner of the Phoenix Suns did not go far enough. The NBA suspended Robert Sarver for a year and fined him $10 million after it discovered years of abusive, lewd, and racist remarks directed toward his employees. LeBron James and Chris Paul, two of the NBA's most respected players, say Sarver's punishment should have been worse. And now even the Suns' co-owner is calling on Sarver to resign. ESPN senior writer Baxter Holmes broke the story that led to the NBA investigation, and he joins us now. Baxter, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
The NBA's investigation came out this week detailing examples of abusive language and behavior by Sarver over his 18 years as owner of the Suns. Can you describe some of the major findings for us?
Certainly. They noted that he was found to have used the N-word at least five times in repeating or purporting to repeat what a black person said, four of those after being told by both black and white subordinates that he should not use that word, even in repetition of each other. They described using language and engaging in conduct demeaning of female employees. They described making jokes frequently to large or small groups of people about sex and sex-related anatomy. On four occasions, they talked about workplace inappropriate physical conduct towards male employees. I think more than 50 current and former employees reported him frequently engaging in demeaning and harsh treatment of employees. There's a lot in the report.
Can you describe one example that stands out to you, Baxter?
Among several, I would say one that stood out to me was they noted in the report he told a pregnant employee that she would be unable to do her job upon becoming a mother. They also noted berating a female employee in front of others and then commenting that women cry too much. Those two definitely jumped off the page to me. And when I think about the initial reporting, when I learned upon that anecdote of him berating this woman, she started to cry, and then he remarked, "Why do all you women here cry so much?" I will say that particular line is one I'm probably going to remember for the rest of my life.
Well, for a lot of people, this story sounds somewhat familiar, like the case of Clippers owner Donald Sterling using abusive and racist language. But Sterling was banned for life from owning a team. NBA Commissioner Adam Silver says the Sarver case is bad, but not as bad as the one against Sterling nearly 10 years ago. Here he is.
Indefensible is not strong enough. It's beyond the pale in every possible way. To use language and behave that way, but that it was wholly of a different kind than what we saw in that earlier case.
What are the similarities and differences between the Sarver case and the Sterling case?
Well, the thing that a lot of folks are focusing on was that in the Sterling case, there was an audio tape of him making racist remarks, and there wasn't in this case. And to that point, and it was in the report, the concept of animus, whether or not these things have, you know, the investigators found that they have been said, these actions took place, but was there animus behind it? Did he mean it? Is he, I think Adam used the phrase, it's hard to know what's in someone's heart. That particular reference, I think, has drawn some criticism from legal experts that I and my colleagues have talked to. I won't speak to why or how Adam reached that point, but those are the key lines of difference between the two.
L.A. Lakers star LeBron James and Suns point guard Chris Paul say the punishment against Sarver does not go far enough. What kind of power does the reaction of players have here, Baxter? And might the stepped-up pressure lead to a greater penalty for Sarver?
I can't overstate enough how much power the players have. I was talking with a colleague yesterday that the line, I think it's from Spider-Man, you know, like, with great power comes great responsibility. Like, the players have enormous power, their voices, their platforms, whatnot. We saw it in the Donald Sterling situation. And then you go on to other things, like if it starts to put more pressure on team sponsors, league sponsors, business partners, all of that, then I'm not sure where it could lead. But certainly, I mean, you referenced it at the top, when John Najafi, the team's second largest stakeholder, called last night for Robert Sarver to resign, that is another strong point. But NBA Media Day for a lot of teams begins in the next 10 days or so. The Phoenix Suns hold theirs on September 26th. It will be very interesting when players are asked about the NBA's report, and we'll see where it leads from there.
What does all of this mean for the team itself? The Phoenix Suns have been one of the best in the NBA. What happens now?
Yeah, you know, and this investigation, ever since my initial story came out and the investigation was launched, has really hung over the team. They have tried to keep it out of sight, out of mind. You know, the NBA is doing this. The investigation is happening. We'll wait for the results. But now that the results are here, and the NBA has these findings, and I think last year it was, like I said, a little bit out of sight, out of mind. The NBA is handling this. It's going on behind the scenes. Our job is just to play basketball. But things feel different now, especially with Chris Paul's comments and the NBA's investigation being over and him being suspended for a year. There's obviously questions about, can he come back in a year? Would he be welcomed back? I'm sure that players will probably get that question. But yeah, there's a lot that remains to be seen. I'll be very interested to hear what players had to say on September 26th.
Baxter Holmes is a senior writer at ESPN. Baxter, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jane Clayson.
I'm Celeste Headlee. It's Here and Now.